Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Coming to you from the Toby Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club, it's Week to Week, the political roundtable from Monday, March 12th, 2018. Welcome, everyone. Now, you might well hear us talk tonight about this amazingly close race in this Republican-leaning congressional district in Pennsylvania called PA-18 for the district. They're holding a special election tomorrow to fill a seat. And Republican commentator and Trump critic Anna Navarro tweeted earlier today, quote, "Amazing we're talking about what a close race PA-18 is. It's a solid Republican district. Trump won it by 20 points. Republicans should be able to nominate a bag of kitty litter and still win it, assuming the bag of kitty litter was not an accused pedophile," unquote. So I'm John Zipper. I'm your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. If any of you know Anna Navarro, please have her get in touch. We'd love to have her join the panel sometime. On tonight, of course, we've got a lot to talk about, and the only challenge really is deciding what we won't be able to fit into this hour. But we'll talk about, of course, the Trump administration versus California, Trump and Kim Jong-un, whom apparently he gets along better with than Jerry Brown, some other state politics, and the youth vote in the post-Parkland era. And, of course, we'll end the evening with our live news quiz. As always, I note that the Commonwealth Club is a place for people with a lot of different viewpoints, so any opinions that are expressed are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. Now let's meet our panelists for today. I'll start on the far end with Joe Garofoli. He's a senior political writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's on Twitter at Joe Garofoli. So welcome back, Joe.
Thank you for having me. Good to be back.
And joining our week-to-week panel for the very first time is John F. Rothman. He's a talk show host with KGO 810 AM. He's on Twitter at John Rothman. That's with two N's. Welcome, John. And next to me is Barbara Marshman, the former editorial page editor for the Mercury News. She's on Twitter at Barb Marshman with one N. Now that she's no longer with the Mercury News, she's unleashed. So we've got her on a six-second delay tonight. No idea what's going on. So welcome back, Barbara.
Thank you.
So for the first topic, I wanted to talk about Jeff Sessions coming to California, speaking, like a 10-minute walk away from Jerry Brown in Sacramento, and taking the state of California generally and Libby Schaaf specifically to task over immigration policies and actions. Governor Jerry Brown attacked Sessions and Trump, calling the administration, quote, full of liars, unquote, and taunting them by saying, Mueller is closing in. So, Barbara, what do you make of that? And would you rather be on the bad side of Jeff Sessions or Jerry Brown?
Well, California has gone very much to the extreme on this, working to pick a fight. I mean, it's the right side to be on of immigration issues, I believe, and I think it would be awful to force local police, for instance, to help ICE raid institutions or homes within their own city. It's really can turn the community, an immigrant community, against the police force. But Jerry is relishing this. You can tell. Yeah. I retired January 31st from the Mercury News, so I was not as steeped in this as I might have been earlier. But just as an outsider looking at it, my jaw dropped. I mean, just the vitriol of the attack on both sides is amazing. I'm not sure where it ends.
Well, pick up and tell you that Libby Schaaf is the happiest person I know.
Oh, yes, yes.
She is now immortalized and has a real political career ahead of her.
She does.
After being the mayor. I have to say that Jeff Sessions is not a particularly popular person here in California. And I would tell you also that it is a question, and I want to use a term called popular sovereignty. It's states' rights versus federal dominance. I thought Jeff Sessions was going to go after us on marijuana because it seemed to me that was a more poignant issue for him. But the bottom line is this will be decided not politically. It'll be decided in the courts. And ultimately, it will go to the United States Supreme Court. And there are four conservative justices and four liberal justices and Anthony Kennedy. And ultimately, how this case is resolved will revolve around what the Supreme Court decides to do.
Joe, and, what did you think?
And because that court case is going to take months, if not years, to figure its way up to the Supreme Court, probably ultimately, the more immediate effect will be political. And it'll be, we'll see the effect of it. We could very likely see the effect of it in our midterm elections here this year in California. This just is another way to jolt the Latino voters and all kinds of immigrant voters, but particularly Latinos. Because this is just another way to scare people and terrorize people in the immigrant community about, like, oh my God, is that, what does this mean? The attorney general is coming here and he's going to ramp up this and sue this. It sounds scary. And so that just energizes immigrant voters, and immigrant voters, particularly Latinos, vote 80% with the Democrats, and so it's a boon to them. And it's also, he wanted it to be a political boon to Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who, when Sessions called him an embarrassment, not even by name, he just said, and your lieutenant governor is sort of an embarrassment. Like, within, like, hours, yeah. He had a fundraising pitch out. Newsom's like, hey, Jeff Sessions called me an embarrassment. If I'm on the wrong side of him, that's a good thing. Click here and give me $5, yeah, yeah. $20, whatever. So it's like everybody's kind of making political hay off of this.
Yep.
So you, John mentioned Libby Schaff, of course. It doesn't hurt to have, a wildly unpopular president and administration in her district attack her, Newsom making hay nationally, statewide in his campaign. What's the impact, do you think, on those few remaining Republican lawmakers in the state? Are they using this to generate support from their base, or are they like, oh, this is going to kill me even in, in increasing?
Did you mean the Republican lawmakers who meet in the phone booth in Sacramento?
They live and they have extra space in there, too. But I mean what impact is it having on them?
You have to deal with it very practically, and we were discussing this earlier in the green room. One of the great tragedies in this state is that there is no Republican Party. There is no real alternative for people. Rather, what we will generally have is a choice between two Democrats running for governor or senator or whatever the case may be. It is unfortunate because the Republican Party can't win. And, of course, they learned that with Pete Wilson and the whole anti-immigration movement then. So history repeats itself. If I were a Republican, I wouldn't be running for governor. Wait a minute. There is no Republican running for governor. That may explain it.
Technically, there is, there's an outside shot that one of them will sneak into the finals. They're like 41% of the vote is supposed to be cast for a Republican. The problem is that there's four Democrats running, two of them with very solid support, and so it's unlikely, but still possible that you could get a Republican in there. We'll
it's
see.
Also well, possible it, it's going to snow here tonight.
Well, I do want to get more into the gubernatorial race a little bit later, but specifically, your thoughts on the Daryl Issas and others?
Right.
Was this another nail in the coffin that some of them were? Daryl Issas not running, am I right?
No, he's not running.
Well, he's definitely not going to win.
No, he's not running for re-election. No.
Then my prediction is he will not win. but again, those remaining Republicans, I mean, help them, hurt them? What do you think?
I think the calculation for, say, Nunez district is going to come down so much to there are, what, 9 Democrats running for his seat. And now they're very smart. A second Republican has stepped up so that there is the possibility of everybody getting low amounts of votes, but the two Republicans possibly making the runoff. And then I assume Nunez would take it. If the Democrats had been able to be an actual organized party, and limit the number of people filing in that seat, I think Nunez would be in trouble, and I think this would put him in deeper trouble. But as it is, I'm really not sure. I think the Democrats have diluted the field so much that just with his very core base, he may make it back.
Rohrabacher, I think you mean.
Rohrabacher,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah, then Nunez. Yeah, that's the problem. And so the party chair, for the Democratic Party chair, is in the uncomfortable position of saying, we have an overpopulation problem. We have too many candidates running. So, after Trump won, a lot of Democrats were like, you know, I want to do something about that, so I'm going to run for Congress, even though I have no experience, or that's you know, I guess that's fine these days. We elected a president based on that. And a lot of them have money as opposed to like fringy candidates who just say, I'm running for Congress and I have I've raised $1,000. Can I make it? Yeah. Well, these people have raised several hundred thousand dollars. So now the party leaders and the Democratic Party out of Washington, who's here, has to go and say, you know, hey, maybe have you ever thought about running for state assembly or the water board or do something else? Because if there's too many Democrats, as Barb said, if there's five Democrats in some of these seats and, you know, one or two Republicans or one incumbent and another guy, you know, and nobody knows who the hell the Republicans are or the Democrats are, then they'll say, like, they'll split the vote and two Republicans could wind up getting in. So the Democrats could have too much of a good thing in some of these congressional races.
When conservative Charlie Sykes was here and we were asking him, so, you know, what are the chances of President Trump being reelected? And he said, better than you think, because, you know, not my words, not his, but my interpretation of what he was saying was, never count out the Democrats of being able to screw up a good thing. Mm-hmm. They certainly have the enthusiasm and the turnout in their favor. And tomorrow we will see the Pennsylvania vote. But you know, there's something to be said in from just the purely Machiavellian side of someone being able to in that back room say, okay, we're putting forward these two candidates, not these 13.
Right.
Since I just introduced it again, what are your thoughts on the Pennsylvania race? Do you think there's a good chance that the Democrats... This is a suburban Pittsburgh?
Yeah,
it's Pittsburgh. I believe it's your old stomping ground.
Yes, oh, is it? Mom's, I'm Philadelphia end, yeah. So... Yeah.
So
you would know.
It's a kind of a weird district because you have it's kind of a suburban area, then it goes into more of a rural area, and it's very conservative. A lot of the folks there are folks who, if they were not displaced by the one of the industries there, coal industry, steel industry, their dad was, or their uncle was, or so. There's a lot of feel, like when he talks about we're bringing back steel, that resonates there because people feel that way. They want to, you know, they feel bad. Their family's livelihood was lost because of, you know, a corporation moved and could make steel cheaper somewhere else. This could go either way. It's all the polls, even the latest polls, so it's very close. It would be a huge upset if the Democrat won. But even Democrats in Western Pennsylvania are not Democrats like the people in this room.
Right.
I mean, the people in this room are socialists compared to the people in Western Pennsylvania who are Democrats. They're much more very centrist. They might have different views on abortion rights. And they're also much less diverse. It's a very white area.
The latest poll, which I read this afternoon, is that Lamb, the Democrat, is up by 6 points. So I only want to indicate to you that even if Lamb loses by a point or two, it is a big blow to the Republicans because Donald Trump carried the district by 20 points. My expectation is that this will cause a real rethink on the part of the Republicans because they do not, let me underline that, do not want to lose control of the House of Representatives. But I would say that there is a tide running, and I want to indicate that one of the issues, it's a labor district. It is a very active labor movement district, and the Republican nominee is in favor of right-to-work laws. And that will, I think, really do him damage. The last point I would make is that the Republican chairman is now distancing himself from the Republican candidate and saying the reason the Democrat is doing so well is because he sounds just like a Republican.
And didn't he also call it a Democratic district? I saw that earlier
today. Yes, he called it a Democratic. But I'm not sure if he meant that or whether he simply misspoke.
Okay.
But it could well be a Democratic district, and if I can expand just quickly, the president's rally the other night, Saturday evening, I think did the Republican tremendous damage because Donald Trump did not mention his name more than a few times. He talked about himself repeatedly. Can you imagine him doing that? I just don't get it. But the bottom line here is all of us will be glued tomorrow night because if Lamb wins, it is going to be a sad day for the Trump people.
Yeah, it's really seen as a referendum on how much Donald Trump can help or hurt a candidate. Mm-hmm. And if this race is even close, I don't think we'll see Donald Trump on the campaign trail that much later in the year.
Someone in the audience asks if the federal government would benefit with term limits. It's kind of a perennial question, but with all the Republicans who have decided to not run this next year, they've kind of termed themselves out.
There are 37 Republicans who have decided not to run, but personally, very quickly, I'm opposed to term limits, always have been. If I want to term limit somebody, I'll do it at the ballot box.
I totally agree. I've never supported term limits. I don't, you know, maybe three-term, four-term for some local, you know, giving people 12 or 16 years, maybe after that. But
the Chinese president, for example.
The president, yeah, well, president, two terms. I kind of like that for president because
of China.
but for most races, including congressional, mm-hmm. I think it's really important to let people decide.
Can I also just throw in, I was Milton Mark's chief of staff two separate times during his almost four decades in the legislature, and I can tell you one of the greatest tragedies for the people of this state was when 140 passed, and all of a sudden you had term-limited veterans of the state legislature. You know who runs the state legislature today? The staff. The staff runs the state legislature, not the elected representatives. And I can remember, as Milton left office, new people coming in would say, now, how do we do this? How do we do that? Because it takes a while to get your sea legs to know what to do when you're in elected office.
And there's also much more vulnerability to lobbyists if you're coming in fresh and you don't really know the landscape.
Yeah, they have the institutional memory. Okay, let's talk North Korea. So President Trump reportedly decided pretty much on the spot to accept a surprise offer of a meeting with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un recently. The North Koreans supposedly lured Trump by suggesting they would freeze missile tests and could even give up their nukes. Joe, Trump likes to do things differently from his predecessors. I maybe play devil's advocate. Could this
could it
turn
be
out
so
well?
Crazy at work? there's so much we don't know about this. Mostly because the Secretary of State didn't know what the president was doing. So if he doesn't know, and that's kind of his department, there isn't an ambassador to South
Korea. There's no ambassador to South Korea, and the senior person in the State Department dealing with that area resigned last week.
So
what could
speaking of institutional knowledge, I mean, and what's the pitch? What are they going to talk about? What do they want? You know, they say the denuclearization of the whole peninsula. Well, are the South Koreans in on that? I mean, is everybody cool with that? Is it the Japanese? I mean, it doesn't seem like they have everybody on the table together. And if the president's going to go off, you know, on a lark on this, it doesn't seem like there's a whole hell of a lot of planning going on. It's great that they're talking and not, you know, threatening each other with nuclear weapons. That's good. And beyond that, I mean, there's so many unknowns.
Winston Churchill once said, better jaw-jaw than war-war. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes great sense. But I can tell you, and anybody who's studied diplomatic history, and many of you know I worked for Richard Nixon, one of the things that Nixon did was to prepare for a summit. He really did his homework. He knew who he was dealing with, the direction that he had to go. And I think that's important. The other example is Ronald Reagan at Reykjavik. And you may recall that Ronald Reagan got rid of all of his aides. He sat down with Gorbachev and he said, we want to do away with nuclear weapons, at least between our two nations. The stumbling block was the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, as it was euphemistically called. But the simple truth is that you cannot go into a summit as a loose cannon because it just doesn't work. There's one last point, and that is we don't know if there will be a summit. And that's one of the real questions that has to be asked. There are a lot of things which the bureaucrats, whether you like them or not, are going to insist be worked out. And Donald Trump is like a bull in a china shop. And the question will be whether or not, when all the damage is done, whether he can put the pieces together. If he does, if he succeeds, I know you're going to think I'm nuts when I say this, but let's assume they denuclearize the entire peninsula. I can see a joint Nobel Peace Prize between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un. What have you been smoking?
Wow.
Any thoughts, Barbara? I mean, he's a negotiator. This is a...
He's a negotiator, but he's also... He's a negotiator who breaks his word as soon as he's walked out of the room. I mean, he's done it with Democrats. He's done it with his own party. He yeah. said he'd sign bills that he didn't... So I could see him if Kim is smart enough to be flattering and you know... I was going to say suck up. Can we say suck up?
No, I think he would offer to build a Trump Tower at Pyongyang.
A wall, perhaps.
Sure. A wall, yes, sure.
A wall.
A parade.
He could offer to plan the parade for him. I see no good coming of it.
Okay, well, we haven't talked enough about someone named Donald Trump, so I want to get into a number of things around Donald Trump. He is, in fact, coming to California this week, the state he loves to hate. And, of course, California is gearing up for the experience. Maybe lay the groundwork, Joe. What do we know about where he's going and what he's going to
do? Well, he's going to go down and check out to the border, check out the prototypes for the wall. And then he's going to go to a fundraiser in Los Angeles. This is going to be the Woodstock of protests here. Everybody and their mom is going to be down at this thing. You're going to have immigrant rights communities. You're going to have environmental communities. You're going to have all the indivisible groups that have been forming. They're all heading down there. This is going to be two audiences here. One, the California audience, mm-hmm. who are like, yeah, Trump's horrible. And then there's going to be the red state audience and the 35% of the folks in the country who support Trump. And so Trump's going to go like, look how crazy these Californians yep. are. And do you want these people running your country with their crazy sanctuary cities and blah, blah, blah. And so that's what we're going to be seeing tomorrow. It's going to be very hard for the demonstrators to get real close to the wall because it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere and they can seal that off. And very little information so far about, you know, the fundraiser and stuff, but that'll leak out and that place will be surrounded. So it's going to be a lot of chaos and images, competing images tomorrow. And both interests will be served. Yeah. You know, Trump's interests will be served because he'll be there. I came to California, and they're wacky, and you know, I'm standing up to them. We're going to build the wall, and then the people, the demonstrators will be like, you know, he's a whack, and we're standing up against him. This is the resistance against Trump. Mm-hmm. So it'll be fun to watch.
John, all theater.
All theater, and I'm glad he's coming. I'm glad he's coming because I think it's an important statement that the President of the United States comes to California. The fact that he has declared war, essentially, on this state on every level makes it a far more dramatic confrontation. And stop and think about it. When does Donald Trump excel? When he has confrontation. When there is a vigorous fight to be fought. And I would suggest to you that Donald Trump is more excited about coming to California than we are in receiving him. And I think Joe's point is spot on, and that is that he is playing to several different audiences. So we're going to have to wait and see. I'm just sorry he's not coming to San Francisco. Wait. We've had many presidents speak at the Commonwealth Club.
There you go.
If only he'd been here.
We have invited him. We make that overture now because I'm sure he's watching us right now on YouTube. Well, he could be. Barbara and the three of you can moderate the program when he does come here. But your thoughts, Barbara, on his trip? Do you agree or do you?
I agree that it's all theater. I think it benefits Trump with his base, mm-hmm. and may even help a little bit with the middle because everybody outside of California likes to think California is crazy. But I think. What you're all looking at.
I would actually bring this back to what I was saying earlier yeah. about, you know, the few Republican members of Congress from California, and that if the Trump approach is basically saying we're willing to sacrifice them,
yeah,
because they're not going to be helped by, you know, that 35% or whatever is not going to to help them in California much, unless they're in a super-duper red central district or whatever.
Yeah.
But again, like you're saying, elsewhere, where the base is and where they'll really need them in November, that it would be helpful for that.
Right. These members of Congress who are running, the incumbents especially, the Democrats are targeting about seven, depending on the day,
right,
7 to 10 districts in California, really seven, where Hillary got Republican-held districts where Hillary Clinton got more votes than Trump. And those incumbents do not want to answer the question, what do you think about Trump? Well, what do you think about what he said today? What do you think? Because they're in a bad spot, especially in a tight primary, because in a primary, you want to bring out that's who the most conservative voters turn out. So you can't really tick off those folks. And but at the same time, you if you survive that primary and you go in the general election and you're seen as, you know, walking arm in arm with Trump, the general population of voters are not Trump voters in many cases. They're, you know, in some of these Southern California districts, they might be a little bit more Trump friendly, but it's a really tough position for them to be in.
I want to come back to the proposition that all politics are local. If you're a member of Congress and you answer your constituents quickly and efficiently, you're not going to necessarily be dragged down by an unpopular president. What I will look for is what Republican member of Congress stands next to Donald Trump and wants his or her picture taken with him. But remember, the first rule of politics, get reelected.
Yeah, I think there'll be one. And one you can guarantee. Two you can guarantee. Nunes and McCarthy.
Right. Well,
and
yeah. Nunes.
I don't
is
know
going
after that.
That
it's
and you
be.
Understand, Nunes is going to be reelected. McCarthy, who is the number two Republican in the House, yeah, could, if Paul Ryan steps out, become Speaker of the House of Representatives. So there is a lot of political messages that we need to evaluate.
Well, if Democrats are really hoping for the Hispanic vote to get them over the top, I think Nunes is pretty much counting on the Russian vote. So the latest,
I love a neutral moderator.
Welcome to Week to Week. Here's something I think we all agree on. The latest today is that Stormy Daniels has offered to return the $130,000 to Trump's lawyer, who was, of course, good-hearted enough to give her the money, even though she says she didn't do anything. I think all of us who have not had an affair with Donald Trump are looking forward to our $130,000. But this story is sticking around and getting, I think, more interesting. And I think we were talking before in the green, before we came out here. My interpretation is, or my guess is, and it's a guess, that offer was not necessarily a serious offer that she expected or her lawyer expected to be taken up. It was to make some hay with the White House, because the White House, of course, has said, of course, we have nothing to do with this. And so they can't respond to it. And I think they would even have a harder time back channel to the lawyer to tell him what to do.
The offer was not to return $130,000 to Michael Cohen. It was to return $130,000 to Donald J. Trump. And that, of course, is interesting. But I want to tell
Denison.
You, the question of whether or not they had a relationship is not what's impactful here. It's the question of whether or not it was an illegal campaign contribution.
Right. Exactly.
Common Cause has filed suit with the federal election people to determine whether or not this was an illegal campaign contribution. And that would have significance and is of interest. And the other question, of course, will be if Donald Trump is deposed, whether it's on Stormy Daniels or whether it is on Russia, remember that the most important single thing the president's lawyers want is to keep him away from a sworn deposition. Because if he does not tell the truth, he is subject to charges of perjury and obstruction of justice. And I would remind you, if you look at the number one charge against Bill Clinton, the bottom line charge, that was it, perjury and obstruction of justice. So the lawyer's job is to protect the president, frankly, from himself. And Stormy Daniels' job is to make as much money as she can out of this deal,
yes,
which she is going to do.
Yes.
Yeah, she's already many offers to pay her $130,000.
You know that 60 Minutes, Anderson Cooper has already done a film of her. I don't know whether it's going to be next week or the week after, or if miraculously she were able to be released from her non-disclosure, whether they'd have to do another interview. But it's a very interesting situation. You know, I often say I teach a course on first ladies and presidential affairs. And in many cases...
We're not talking about the semester long course, right?
Not affairs of state, for sure. Can you imagine, by the way, how Melania must feel? And can you imagine how their 10-year-old son must feel hearing about this? It's a very difficult business. I went back and reread Hillary Clinton's memoir just to see how Chelsea reacted in a situation like that. The people I really feel sorry for, sympathy for, are the president's family.
But what do you guys think that, you know, his people care about this? Like, on the base level of he had an affair with a porn star. I mean, after all this stuff, I mean, I every once in a while my editors say, well, do you think this is going to, you know, I've been three or four stories. Do you think this base is going to care about this? And the answer is usually no.
He got a mulligan. He got a mulligan from Tony Perkins. He got a mulligan, a pass.
Franklin Graham.
Franklin Graham gives them a pass.
Yes, these are evangelical Christian leaders.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Silvio Berlusconi, who I guess is making a comeback in Italy, you know, when he left office, it wasn't over his bunga-bunga parties. It was over corruption and other issues, and even that didn't ultimately keep him from coming back to power. So, and you do have that part of the population that, that's my guy.
Yeah, they made their deal, or the voters have made formed their opinion. They're like, well, that's Trump.
Well, but I mean, actually, a seedier side of that, which is that they like that about him.
Remember what Donald Trump said. He could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue, and his base would still vote for him.
Yeah.
The ultimate tragedy is that we are so locked into positions that even when the positions are wrong, we seem to be inflexible. And I would also remind you, when Dick Nixon left office, about 30% of the American people supported him even though he chose to resign. And that is an indication that there are blocks of voters who, no matter what the facts are, I like to say, don't confuse people with the facts.
I do think it's interesting that the Republican Party that had claimed the moral high ground in these areas has now just completely given it up. It is one of the ways in which the party is possibly permanently changed because of Donald Trump.
Someone in the audience asks, but how can any woman support Trump?
I asked that question during the campaign. when the tape came out and his use of grabbing a woman's private parts, I found it absolutely incomprehensible. But again, remember what Donald Trump said in the rally. 52% of women voted for him. By the way, that's not true. It was 52% of white women. Mm-hmm. But again, I want to remark, don't confuse people with the facts, particularly not the president.
Okay. Someone else asks about a topic I wanted to get into anyway, which was the tariffs that the president has already issued, or he signed the order for, am I right? Obviously, we're a political show, not an economics show, but let's get into a little bit about the politics of that, because it has not pleased his own Republican fellow party.
106 members of the Republicans in Congress have protested this. The opposition to the president is real. I want to remind everybody that historically, the Republicans favored a high tariff to benefit the business interests, and Democrats favored a low tariff to benefit the people. And again, we are seeing a stunning situation. And again, let me point out, that can be overturned, but only by Congress. And there are not the votes in Congress to overturn what the president's done.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
It It's another interesting example of the president announcing something with absolutely no research, backup. I mean, he clearly thought he was going after China and not Canada. And Canada and Mexico now have gotten a kind of pass.
And Australia.
And Australia. And maybe South Korea. They can talk about South Korea. So it's another reason why putting Trump in a room with someone to make promises is not a good thing.
And you'll notice how when he's in a room and he makes a promise, just take a look at guns, mm-hmm. the promises or the assertions that he made, the White House statement this morning is a complete retreat from what Donald Trump said. No surprise, necessarily, because the NRA gave him $30 million. But it goes to show you that when you're dealing with Donald Trump, you can't just take him at his word.
Yeah, well, he loved the moment.
Yeah.
The almost the reality TV moment of being around and Feinstein. Oh, yeah, and they were, everybody was buddies. And it was a surprising moment. It's so disturbing where he's playing for that, it seems. Yeah. Like at lack of coming up with a better motivation than actual real policy or to move the country forward. So that's really like deeply disturbing, beneath the craziness of it.
Can I just make a quick comment on this?
Sure, John.
I played Saturday night on the air Lyndon Johnson's statement following his signing of a gun control law in October of 1968. President Johnson called for gun registration, for licensing, and he issued an attack on the gun lobby. He said, that's the obstruction here. That was 50 years ago, 1968. And as we're approaching the anniversary, the tragic commemoration of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. and the assassination of Robert Kennedy, we need to reflect on where we are 50 years later. We are certainly not where we should have been. I also played a clip of Bobby Kennedy's speech up in Roseburg, Oregon, just a week before he died, calling for gun control. And by the way, nobody wants to take people's guns away. Nobody that I know favors that. We're talking about restrictions on the use of particular weapons, and there is not a reason in the world for a person to own a weapon which is a weapon of war.
On that note, still keeping with Trump before we move on, what do you make of the rumors that President Trump wants his chief of staff, John Kelly, to get rid of Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump? Is this because worries about the Mueller thing, or is this about the trouble they're having with security clearances? Any thoughts on that? Or do you think that was just all?
I don't know. I don't think those guys are going anywhere. That's you can't, you're going to fire your own daughter.
Yeah, Kelly's not going to fire them for Trump. No, I mean, if they're going, they're going because Dad says so.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, then I said I wanted to get more into the gubernatorial election because there has been some stuff happening. Polls, I guess, are currently showing that Gavin Newsom and Antonio Villaraigosa are closely being tied.
One poll, the Public Policy Institute of California poll, has that the Newsom camp said, oh, it's an outlier. But that's what we're sticking with right now.
An opinion piece in the Orange County Register noted the showdown between these two, between Lieutenant Governor and former San Francisco Mayor Newsom and former Los Angeles Mayor Villaraigosa. The article said the election will come down to whether Californians hate Los Angeles more or hate San Francisco more. Joe, you've written about some recent activity by another name in the race, John Chang.
Yes.
And he's, in fact, going after Villaraigosa.
Yeah, this is a change in policy. In fact, he did it again today.
Yeah.
Chang got a endorsement from an SEIU, I believe, based in Southern California.
Yeah.
And then so he used that announcement to rip on Villaraigosa for being anti-union as mayor and fired a lot of city employees, or laid off a lot of city employees. And that was because it was during the recession and they were trying to cut budgets. So he went after him on that. And so what that tells you is that Chung has raised a decent amount of money, but he has not made no movement in the polls. So he's going to... And he's been very mild-mannered on the campaign trail, but now he is swinging directly at Villaraigosa, who is right above him or even with him, depending on the poll of the day that you read. So, and the Republicans in the race are kind of mired in the middle of where Chung is, and they're not making a whole hell of a lot of movement either. So it's a race for number two now. Newsom is most polls show him out front.
Yeah. We'll choose between two Democrats. That's what's going to happen. And really, when you boil it down, there is very little difference on policy between Newsom and Villaraigosa. So it really is going to boil down to Southern California versus Northern California. I agree with you completely in terms of who turns out voters. And that may be the ultimate factor.
I find it interesting that business seems to be going for Villaraigosa fairly dramatically compared to Gavin Newsom. When Gavin was running for lieutenant governor, he was all over Silicon Valley, and you know, and I thought he was friendly with the Silicon Valley leadership. That all seems to have gone away. And
why do you think that is? I mean, he is a businessman.
Gavin. Well, you know, for one thing, Gavin's all about Gavin. You know, you just never really know. Also, he started some kind of business roundtable when he became lieutenant governor and promised great things for it. And then, of course, Jerry Brown wanted nothing to do with him and just said, you know, go do whatever you want. And it just went nowhere. And some say it went nowhere because Gavin just let it go and started working on his next campaign. But I really don't know. If I were still at the paper, I would be working very hard right now to find out where Villaraigosa's business support comes from, because there seems to be a real sense that he has a business orientation.
Well, it might stem from he has stood up to labor, unlike Newsom has. Newsom has actively courted, because, I mean, let's face it, Newsom has a San Francisco Bay Area base, but he doesn't have a statewide base, so he has made his base with the progressive unions, the nurses, SEIU, and so on. So he's tried to court that crowd to build a constituency for himself. And so maybe that's where some of the business, they're like, well, Villaraigosa has stood up to the teachers union when he was down there. He stood up to some of the city employee unions there. So they might see him as sort of, if not necessarily business friendly, but, you know, I will be a Democrat, the rare Democrat to stand up to labor.
Yeah.
And remember, we in Northern California really don't know Villaraigosa.
No.
He has not had an opportunity to present his case here in an effective fashion. And the real critical question will be voter turnout. And if the Southern California bloc remains, then Newsom has a problem. Any Northern Californian would, no matter how capable they might be.
Someone in the audience asks, moving to the Senate race, what about Dianne Feinstein? We all saw she did not get the endorsement from the Democratic Party convention. Was that a surprise, Joe?
I was at the convention. It was not a surprise. The convention is, it looks a lot, first of all, she does not court that crowd. She does not come back for the convention. She doesn't do the retail politics. There is a lot of respect among the party's grassroots activists for Senator Feinstein, but they're not in love with her. They want her in the age of resistance and being loud and pushing back loudly against President Trump. That's not her style. You know, her style is to, you know, devour the briefing books and come at it from a policy perspective and sort of try and capture the middle ground and that kind of stuff. So that's, her voice is not one that kind of matches the moment for a lot of these activists. So that part was not surprising. Now, Dianne Feinstein has $10 million in the bank, personal fortune of upwards of, if I pick a number, 50, 75 million. I think the latest was 50 million on paper. We don't know how much it could be. her main competitor, State Senator Kevin DeLeon from Los Angeles, was the head of the state Senate. He has $350,000 in the bank. Yes, Buffy Wicks, who's running for the Assembly in the East Bay, has raised more money than he has.
Stormy Daniels could help.
Maybe she'll do a fundraiser for him. It could, you know, win-win for everybody there. And he's like, he's way behind in the polls. But, you know, he will move on since there's no Republican, as John's said earlier, going to be in the finals or make it up to the primary. This will be, those two will be in the top two for the November race, and so we'll be seeing them for another 6 months.
I talked to a Republican friend of mine, and I asked, who are you voting for? And he said, Dianne Feinstein. I said, really? And he said, yes, John, I've listened to you over the years on the radio say that Dianne Feinstein is the best Republican in the Democratic Party.
She gets very angry if you say that to her.
I know she does.
She will call out. I mean, made a reference to her once in an editorial. Didn't even think it was a big deal. And, man, I got that phone call.
But Dianne is capable. Remember, she will be 84 years old. That's her disadvantage. I can tell you that in Washington, she is highly regarded, highly respected. She has seniority, which benefits this state tremendously. Her health is excellent. And when we talk about her appeal, it's not just the Democratic base, and that traditionally is what we want in a senator, somebody who can represent the state of California. What's interesting to me is if something had happened to Dianne, if she hadn't been able to run, the person I would have looked at was Adam Schiff, because I think he very much would have liked to have jumped in, but he couldn't because Dianne is Dianne, and this will be her last term in all likelihood, and I fully expect, short of a health problem, that she will be reelected to another term.
Adam Schiff is one of those people who just came out of nowhere during the Trump investigations and just presents so evenly and fairly. He came in to meet with us last year, and I have to say he's sort of the same way in person. He's not somebody you're going to joke a lot with, but I just find him a very interesting person.
I've done a couple podcasts with him, and he has a little bit of a looser side, and he can be a little bit of dry humor and stuff. I like him. I think he's super smart and does what he does. I was talking to a Democratic operative the other day. It was very well up there, and it was kind of like, well, is Schiff a one-trick pony? Maybe he's a really good committee head. You know, he's really good at what he does now. But on the trail, how does he project? I mean, how does he, you know, can he get up in Fresno and say, all right, let's talk about the farm workers? Can he get up in on the coast and talk about the environment? I think he does do that because he has more.
We'll find out, Joe.
We'll find out. We'll see. He's young enough. I think he's maybe early 50s. So he has, he's at Feinstein. He's another 30 years ahead of him.
Very good. I also wanted to talk about the youth vote, youth activism in this post-Parkland era. In the days and weeks following that shooting at the Parkland High School in Florida, student survivors of the tragedy have emerged as effective communicators and organizers, taking on legislators who have basically bottomless wells of thoughts and prayers, but apparently absolutely are empty as far as legislation. Since then, there hasn't been any national legislation. We have seen some interesting stuff in Florida, where they have voted to raise the minimum age to buy a gun, and I think they banned bump stocks. Is that?
No, that's going to be federal, but the simple truth is the NRA immediately went to court.
Yeah.
And again, let me remind everybody that when this went to the court over the Washington, D.C. Handgun provision, the court ruled 5-4, so that's going to be the challenge. The bottom line, I think, of your question is, will young people make a difference? I sure hope so. In our generation, we made a difference in the civil rights movement. There's no doubt that a difference was made on the war in Vietnam. And I think that the enthusiasm, the brilliant rhetorical abilities demonstrated by some of the students in Florida, will it translate into a political base? Remember that when you have an emotional issue and you can run on that issue and run hard on that issue, it makes a big difference. When the issue dissolves, when it's resolved, then what are you running on? It's not just that you're young. There has to be more to it. But what happened in Florida, turning around Rick Scott, the governor, was a remarkable achievement. And now I was asked the other night on the radio, what do we do about the NRA? So here's my advice. Every gun owner in America should join the NRA and take it back, because it was hijacked in 1976 or 77 by Charlton Heston and Wayne LaPierre. And if gun owners in America want gun rights protected, but also want people protected, and a lot of gun owners feel that way, join the NRA and turn them around.
Yeah.
The one thing about the kids, and wrote about this a few weeks back, it's very unusual to see high school kids getting involved. And there's such a fresh voice, and I think that's what resonated, especially the survivors and mm-hmm. people saw their, you know, their friends killed and such. That it was, it's really powerful. The challenge with high school kids sustaining a movement is that they're high school kids. Right. First of all, the seniors are going to be dispersing soon, either going to work or going to college and such. Are they going to stay in the movement? And then, you know, the younger kids are, can I get out tonight? I have to, get the car home. And we'll see in a couple weeks when the big rally comes, or I'm sorry, in a couple days, what's going to happen when these kids walk out of school? Are they going to be? It's not like college. You can
remind everybody what's going to happen.
You'll get suspended. You may get suspended. Around here, the administration is. I know a number of schools are a little friendlier about it because their politics are different. But in other parts of the country, what's going to happen? These kids are going to get suspended, and then what happens? It'll be an interesting moment to see how this social movement can last, because there's it's an unusual amount of fresh energy there. Yeah. But what happens to it?
I just know if I had young kids, I would do everything I could to move to Parkland and get them into that school district, because I have never seen as many articulate young people speaking clearly from the heart, not overly. A few of them had obviously prepared some lines, but they could hold it, you know, with the best of them. They could,
why? They have a debate operation at Parkland, and the kids are trained in speech and debate. And as somebody who went through speech and debate all through high school and college, I would require speech and debate if I were in school, so that people would have a chance. And just so you understand this, my speech coach, the late Sanford Chandler, I used to go into class at 6:30 in the morning, and he'd choose a topic and I'd talk about it. And then in the middle of talking about it, he'd clap his hands and I had to flip sides so I could debate both sides of an issue. And I think the more we teach our kids to think, the better off we're going to be in terms of our future.
Yep.
I do think it's been interesting seeing all the people lauding the young people, but kind of doing they're going to get this done because, you know, the other generations haven't. And I do think that kind of undersells a lot of folks who, especially the mothers after Sandy Hook and others, who in fact started national organizations and have been doing quite a bit.
So. Age for activism is no barrier.
Yes. Very good. We've got a number of questions from the audience I want to try to get through before we get to the news quiz. So this kind of harks back to us talking about the Dianne Feinstein and other internal Democratic stuff. Will the DNC ever be able to come forward with a platform that will bring the two diverse wings of the party together? Any thoughts?
When was the last time anybody read a party platform? You know, what happens in a campaign is they become supercharged by candidates, by people who capture the imagination. It's not by the texts of resolutions. What we've learned about resolutions in the party is that's what divides a party. So having a platform may be a good thing, but having a good candidate is the most important factor in an election.
Yeah. But also having people who are willing to judge a candidate by less restrictive rules than they seem to be now. I mean, that's my concern with the Democrats. They themselves are divided. Joe, you see it.
Yeah, and even Bernie Sanders said this past platform was the most progressive ever, and the California Democratic Party platform, if you read it, it's very progressive. But at the same time, there's still the problem with superdelegates. I think what a lot of the party activists, especially the Bernie-crat crowd, is like. It's still run in the kind of backroom way in many ways. And the party faithful will say, no, that's how we keep from, some crazy person taking over the party. Well, you lost to a crazy
person. Remember that was a reaction to the Democratic Convention 50 years ago that nominated Hubert Humphrey, who did not run in a single primary. Right. And we all remember Mayor Daley and his power. In 1972, the Democrats had new rules. The McGovern Commission put them in. George then ran for the nomination, won the presidency. But remember that the Democratic Party as a unit had a real problem in 72. because they were so dysfunctional. I want a strong two-party system. I want Democrats who can work, and I want Republicans who can work. And frankly, that will ensure a strong democracy in this country.
Oh, by the way, just looping back to the kids and tying into that, a bunch of those 16, 17-year-olds have already started to
register.
And they're registering as declined a state. Many of them. So they're frustrated with the party system.
Isn't the second largest group in California? Unaffiliated.
It's close. Yeah. So then when the Republicans are practically even, but 24-25%.
Yeah, but in California, declined states really are just like Democrat curious, aren't they?
No, I think they're kind of Republican frustrated.
An audience member writes, President Trump has let China become the dominant power in Asia and largely with Africa, and has let Putin undermine the Atlantic Alliance. So if Trump is defeated in 2020, or forced out otherwise, can the U.S. reassert its global influence? Has this been, A, do you believe this has been serious damage done, or, and if so,
we already had a problem with China over the last three presidential administrations. As for Russia, it's always been a problem. It's a consistent issue on so many levels. We are the dominant force in the world, militarily, politically, and economically. And the world cares tremendously about what America does. When Angela Merkel made the comment that because of Donald Trump's presidency, Europe didn't know who to follow, it goes to show you the importance of presidential leadership. Who is president matters. And the fact that Donald Trump does not have the confidence of foreign leaders and, in fact, has done tremendous damage to American prestige is something I believe that we have to take into account and I hope will change when we have a change in administration.
And I think it will be possible. I think we can turn that battleship.
We are the greatest country in the world, and nobody should ever doubt that. We're the economic engine. Why do you think when China controls $2 trillion of American debt, they don't pull the rug out from under us? Because if our economy fails, their economy fails. And the world understands the central role of America in the economic prosperity and success of this world.
Yeah. It's hard to be too afraid of the Russians when their economy is not all that strong. We should be afraid of them because they're screwing with our elections, and it looks like they're going to do it again. But their economy is not one to be feared.
Yet. Exactly.
Okay. Someone writes about the hundreds of women who are running for political office. Do you think that this surge is an indication of higher participation in turning government, changing government, or is it a reaction to Trump's disrespect for women?
I don't think it matters personally. I think we need more women in government, and I think government would work differently if we had more women in it. Not to diss my male companion, but it's just, I mean,
agreed.
There are differences. Okay. So we'll stipulate. So I don't really care why. I'm sure in some cases it's a reaction to Trump. In some cases, it may be, hey, maybe I do have a chance now that I might not have had before.
I hope it's a reaction to Betsy DeVos, who I listened to last night with complete incredulity on 60 Minutes. It, to me, and I understand the need for gender equality. I'm a great advocate for gender equality and always have been. But it is important for both parties to find the right people who represent the best values. And what stuns me is that Betsy DeVos is still Secretary of Education. It's mind-boggling. And who let her go on 60 Minutes and talk the way she did? I mean, it's just astounding.
Reportedly, the White House is just very displeased with her.
Yeah, but when you say the White House is displeased, there's a real question. Sometimes when the White House is displeased, they make their displeasure known. Wait a minute. Jeff Sessions is not Donald Trump's favorite cabinet member. But it turns out that you don't have to be the favorite cabinet member to survive. Betsy DeVos and her family contributed tens of millions of dollars to the Republican Party and to Donald Trump. She does represent Donald Trump's position, for instance, on school choice. She disses public schools, so does he. So the question will be whether or not there is a reason for Donald Trump to dump her. And remember, he's playing to his base, and his base loves Betsy DeVos.
Okay. Any last thoughts, Joe?
Yeah, in terms of the why women are running, the number of stories on that, and the main reason is President Trump. The frustration that he was elected, that Hillary Clinton lost, and then when the Women's March came along, it was very empowering. You see, like, you know, millions and millions of women around the country marching, and just being at the one in Washington, that was, you know, we're like, okay, what do we do next? And in many cases, it was, I want to do something personally on this, and that took many forms, and one of them was running for office. And it was encouraged. There's a number of organizations that have been around a while, and they all did a lot to encourage it. So I think that the president's election was the root of that.
Very good. Well, let's move on to our news quiz. If we could maybe raise the lights so I can actually see folks when I call on them.
I love these blue lights, by the way. It's my first time in the new place. I like the kind of cool blue lights. I feel
it's
like I'm on a Virgin Atlantic flight.
Let's hope we kept them awake. Yeah. That's the critical thing. Yeah.
I'm going to ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. I'll call on you, and you can then shout it out. And Angela will give you chocolate if you're correct. If you do win, please let other people win for the rest of the game. First question is, what U.S. Congresswoman did President Trump say is, quote, very low IQ? Ma'am, right? Sorry? Maxine Waters, that is correct.
Yes.
Of course, he didn't call her. What did former Trump advisor Steve Bannon tell the far-right French National Front Party that they should wear as a badge of honor? Sir, I saw your hand go up right away. Ma'am, I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry.
Racism,
right. He said, being called racist, xenophobes, and nativists. It's a badge of honor. Hey, speaking of the French National Front, the party's leader, Marine Le Pen, she has proposed a new name for the party. What is that?
National Front.
Nope, that's what it currently is. Oh. Anyone see this story? Anyone want to guess? Do you want to guess?
Rassemblement National.
What would that be in English? No, the name I've seen, anyone want to guess, anyone else? It was National Rally.
That's gathering. Yeah.
Is that what it is?
Yes,
probably.
It's close enough.
Yeah.
She wins, yes. And thank you for the French lesson. You already won. You can share it with someone. Next question.
Miracle somebody. It's like a Grateful Dead show.
Yeah.
So Russian president or leader, whatever he is, Vladimir Putin, leader for life probably, talk about no term limits. He said it wasn't Russians who hacked the U.S. election, but he did suggest someone else should be, ma'am, I saw your hand up first.
Jews,
among others. Maybe they're Ukrainians, Tatars, or Tartars, I'm not sure how that's pronounced. He also mentioned Germany, France, or even the United States itself. So, but definitely not Russia. It couldn't be Russia. Okay, so next question. Rapper Snoop Dogg has made an endorsement in the San Francisco mayoral election. Who's getting the Snoop nod? Anyone see that? Along the edge there. London Breed, that is correct.
I thought Snoop was going to be a Leno guy for some reason. I don't know.
Did you see the latest poll? The Chronicle had this morning. The Chronicle, I'm
yes,
the applause.
The guy next to me wrote it, yeah.
Had the poll, and Leno is in third place.
Third place.
If you believe the polls, President Dewey, President Clinton, you never know.
I never believe the Chronicle.
Hunter Lamb.
You say never believe the Chronicle? Okay.
No way. Who was first and second? Breed?
Breed.
And Kim.
Kim surging. Really? A surging Jane Kim, yes. Ah.
Interesting. I'm going to really bore people who are not from San Francisco, but they're also the Board of Supervisors races here, and one of the most closely watched is District 8, which currently has someone who's considered to be in the moderate in office. Running against him is obviously someone from the progressive wing, and I actually took a photo yesterday of a store in that district that actually has signs for both of them in the windows. It's kind of like hedging all our bets. Okay.
An 89-year-old nun collapsed and died in court Friday during hearings related to a contested property sale involving what famous singer? Way in back, sir.
Katy Perry.
Katy Perry, that is correct. President Trump has pardoned a Navy sailor who had been imprisoned for taking photos of what? Way in back. The inside of a submarine, that is correct. Next question.
Stormy Daniels. Come on, nobody's going to say Stormy Daniels on that one. Okay, come on, come on, come on. What's wrong with you people? Come on, that's an easy one.
Following the attempted murder of an ex-Russian spy in London, calls have grown for whom to return millions of dollars from Russian oligarchs?
There we go. There we go. Very nice. Very
who else? Did anyone see this? Am I missing any hands? Okay, it was the Tories, or Conservative Party in Britain. And if you saw the story today, Prime Minister May essentially said it was probably the Russians.
A very eloquent speech, by the way, in Parliament.
John, very international in news quiz this time. This is a little more international than you.
Okay, let's go in a little
observation.
Who did Connecticut Governor, is it Daniel Malloy, said they behave like, quote, a terrorist organization, unquote. Yeah. This is Connecticut's governor right here in front? No. Ma'am, I'm sorry?
NRA.
That's right, the NRA. We're going international again for
there
Joe. Due to a tuberculosis scare, a zoo in England has taken what unusual steps with all of its mammals?
They're inoculating them.
No, they're not. They might want to. Anyone? They're giving them all contraception. Okay. Three package bombs have exploded in what American city? No.
Yeah. Austin.
Austin, Texas. That's correct. And how many? Two left? Okay. New York's Metropolitan Opera fired what legendary conductor over sexual harassment cases? Her hand shot up like a rock, like a North Korean missile. So.
Yes? James Levine.
James Levine. That is correct.
My mother's favorite.
One last one. Let's stay international. Oscar Gröning, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, died in a German hospital at the age of 96. During World War II, he earned what moniker?
The Accountant of Auschwitz.
Yes.
Give him the chocolate. It's his first time.
Thank you.
You know better.
You broke the rule.
I want you to know I couldn't resist.
We're going to have lots more news to talk about. Thank you, Angela. Sorry?
What was your answer?
The Accountant of Auschwitz.
So he was actually... such a horrible note to end the program on. But he was the one who was actually accounting for and making sure the property was taken from the Jews before they were...
You have a happy question just for no chocolate?
Yeah, just...
Okay. There's no chocolate with this, but...
Can't end on Auschwitz.
Okay. What is significant about a French cheese called, this lady might be able to help us, Esquirou? It's a hard sheep's milk cheese. Anyone want to guess? Esquirou. What's special about it?
I was going to share my chocolate if somebody knew the answer.
Okay, well, it's the winner of the 2018 World Championship Cheese Contest. It beat out 3,401 other cheeses.
Sold
in one of my hometowns of Madison, Wisconsin. Listen, we will have a lot more cheese questions and news quiz questions in 2 weeks, on Monday, March 26th, right here at the Commonwealth Club. Thanks to our great panel today, John Rothman, Joe Garofoli, and Barbara Marshman. Thanks to everyone here in attendance and everyone listening and watching online. Have a great week.